Welcome back to SP3. I'm Al, and this is the show that blends space, sports, and spectroscopy, talking about the latest space and chemical research and the latest developments in the sports world. And today, let's talk about a process that's involved in many chemical processes, including those applied to improve sustainability, catalysis. Let me start way back in general chemistry for this topic. For a reaction to start and eventually proceed to completion or to equilibrium, the molecules of reactants are moving around in the reaction vessel and needs to collide with each other to begin the reaction. Once they collide and begin to react, the reactants must proceed through a transition state before resulting in the products. This transition state is kind of like a hill the reactants need to get over before getting to the final products. And this can be shown pictorially on a potential energy diagram. So on this diagram, you have the energy of the reaction on the y-axis, and time or reaction progress on the x-axis. You start out with the reactants on the left, and then an upward curve showing increasing energy as the reaction progresses, reaching a peak and then coming down to the products. This peak, or series of peaks, represent the activation energy of the transition state. For some reactions, the products end up at a higher energy than the reactants, which indicates that the overall reaction is endothermic, meaning that the reaction system absorbs heat from the surroundings. While some reactions end up with the products at a lower energy when compared with the reactants, this indicates an exothermic reaction. The reaction releases heat as it completes in this case. For some reactions, no matter how many collisions the reactant molecules have with each other, the transition state or hill is just too steep for them to get over. Only a handful of collisions may have just enough energy to overcome the steepness of the transition state, and no appreciable amount of product would be acquired. You may think that a reaction that has this kind of energy profile may not be able to proceed at all, but that's where catalysis comes into play. A catalyst is a material that's added to the reactants that's not consumed in the overall reaction. They increase the rate of the reaction by allowing the reactants to interact via a different transition state by utilizing a lower activation energy through a different mechanism. So the hill to climb over is much less steep. Some of the different mechanisms include increasing the reaction rate, the selectivity, or enabling the reaction to take place at a lower temperature. Catalysts don't change the extent of the reaction, have no effect on the equilibrium, do not change the equilibrium constant of the reaction, and do not change the energy difference between the reactants and products, or the energy available to the system. Basically, the difference between the starting materials and the transition state is what the catalyst is changing. The catalyst usually interacts with the reactants to create different intermediates with the lower activation energy before regenerating the catalyst. So they do take place in the reaction. But since the catalyst is not consumed during the reaction overall, very little amounts of catalyst is needed to make the reaction go when compared with the amounts of reactants. And catalysts can take the form of any material, really. When you think of a catalyst, you might think about a material that contains one of those transition metal or rare earth metal elements, and you would be right. These are typically heterogeneous catalysts, which means they interact in a different phase from the reactants. Most of these are solids and work best when the reactants are liquids or gases. But in addition to transition metals like platinum and rhodium and their oxides, you could have alumina, which is aluminum oxide, zeolites, which are aluminum silicates, vanadium oxide, rainy nickel, titanium 3 chloride, etc. And these heterogeneous catalysts are usually, quote, supported by things like silicon dioxide, calcium carbonate, etc., that enhances the effectiveness or lowers the cost. Homogeneous catalysts are usually dissolved in solvent along with the reactants, so that they're in the same phase as the reactants. Some of these are organocatalysts like proline or thiourea, or even free protons in solution. There are also several organometallic catalysts like Wilkinson's catalyst. In addition to these, there are also biocatalysts that include enzymes. And when you think about it, our bodies have tons of different enzymes that complete different functions, so we are driven by catalytic reactions. Metabolism is a major biological process that depends on a catalyst to complete. The activation energy of most metabolic processes are just too high and the rate is too low to proceed without the presence of a catalyst. Light can also be used as a catalyst as well. For example, UV light could be used to provide enough energy to promote the catalyst to an excited state, undergo an intersystem crossing with the reactant, and return to the ground state. The excited reactant would then have enough energy to complete the reaction. And just a quick side note, I didn't know this until I looked it up, but there's actually an SI unit for catalytic activity. It's known as the catal and is measured in moles per second. I've only mainly heard of turnover number, TON, or turnover frequency, TOF, to measure the productivity and activity of the catalyst. Given how much easier they make common chemical processes, catalysts are big business. The global demand for catalysts is about $30 billion, and it's estimated that about 90% of commercially manufactured products involve a catalyst at some point in the process. And this includes generating energy, like the catalytic converter in your car, bulk polymers like polyethylene and polypropylene using Ziegler-Natta catalysts, and pharmaceutical products using catalytic hydrogenation. So you can see just by this very small sample set that lots of research involves catalysts as well. And that includes research into processes that can help us become a more sustainable society. So after this short break, let's talk about what catalysts they include and what process they can improve upon. Before I get into some of the new research I want to discuss in this episode, I want to again mention some research I've already discussed in the ICP, AES, and Sustainability episode, episode 13, because it applies here as well. That research done by Argonne National Laboratory, Ames National Laboratory, the U.S. Department of Energy, Northwestern University, and others were able to come up with a catalyst that selectively converts single-use polyethylene into motor oil and other lubricants or waxes for use in detergent, cosmetics, etc. The catalyst they developed was even able to convert all those single-use plastic bags that you see floating around in the wind everywhere into useful products. So head back to episode 13, ICP AES and its role in sustainability, to learn more about that particular catalyst if you missed it. And that seems to me like a good segue to the first article I would like to talk about. A team from the University of California, Berkeley have developed a new catalytic process that upcycles those single-use polyethylene plastic bags into valuable adhesives. What's interesting about this new process is that a functional group is added to the polyethylene that makes it able to stick to metal and be painted easily with standard latex-based paints, which normally polyethylene can't do. Polyethylene would normally slide right off of metal and the latex paint would just peel off of the surface of the polyethylene. Sometimes when you see polyethylene that has something printed on it, the ink is not latex-based, but it's acrylate-based. The acrylate is used as an adhesive that would stick to the polyethylene. So being able to have regular polyethylene able to be painted without the need for specialized ink or glues would be beneficial. And even though this process adds a functional group that makes the polyethylene stick to metal, it would not alter the physical properties of the polyethylene at all. The ease of processing the polyethylene, the thermal stability, and all the mechanical properties of the original polyethylene are retained, all while increasing its ability as an adhesive. Adding the functional group was tough though, since polyethylene and other plastics like it, such as polypropylene and polystyrene, are pretty resistant to any reactions. That's what makes them great materials for food containers, etc. But to even get to a place where you could get to functionalized polyethylene chains, the team had to find a catalyst that was extremely active for functionalizing methylene groups, which are CH2 groups where the remaining two bonds on the carbon are other single bonds to other carbons. Since polyethylene chains are several thousand carbons long, the vast majority of these chains are CH2s. So having an active catalyst for functionalizing CH2 groups is key. The catalyst also had to function at high temperatures, since the polyethylene had to be melted down and had to work in a nonpolar solvent, since polyethylene is nonpolar. The chosen catalyst was a ruthenium-based catalyst, which ended up being a polyfluorinated ruthenium porphyrin. This catalyst could add OH groups to positions on the polyethylene chain without breaking the chains up. Once these OH groups were added, the team found that this newly functionalized polyethylene could stick pretty well to aluminum metal, and by adding just a very small amount of alcohol, the newly discovered adhesive properties were enhanced 20 times. And the team thinks that the strong adhesion to the metal is through the OH groups, rather than the actual carbon chain. The adhesive abilities of this functionalized polyethylene could be integrated into joint replacements and more common consumer products. Although this has only been shown as effective in polyethylene, further work is underway to see if polypropylene or polystyrene can be altered in a similar way to get more valuable upcycled uses out of these common plastics. So here we have polyethylene being upcycled into valuable adhesives, but there's also research done on converting polyethylene into liquid alkanes that have many uses. The group from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado took samples of pure polyethylene, low-density polyethylene, LDPE, and a post-consumer use LDPE plastic bottle, and utilized a catalyst to convert the plastic into useful products through hydrogenolysis. I'll focus mostly on the plastic bottle, since that is what we could focus on, since there's a lot of LDPE out there that could be upcycled. But for each of the others, the end results were pretty similar, so this technique could be applied to each of those situations. This team was able to convert the plastic bottle into liquid alkanes ranging from C8 to C45, and gaseous alkanes from pure methane, CH4, up to heptane, C7. Running the conditions at an optimal, according to this study, 200 degrees Celsius, 20 bars of hydrogen gas for pressure, and for 16 hours, they were able to selectively convert up to 45% by weight of the LDPE bottle to liquid alkanes, about another 45% to the gaseous alkanes, with the rest as unquantified alkanes. These were possibly branched alkanes that are more difficult to quantify. In order to reach these results, the team utilized ruthenium-based nanoparticles on a carbon support as the catalyst. And they only had to use the catalyst at a 1 to 28 catalyst to polyethylene mass ratio, so not much catalyst at all, to achieve such encouraging results. This elevated pressure of hydrogen was selected as the hydrogen showed an effect for carbon-carbon bond cleavage selectivity and prevented formation of solely methane as the product. The ruthenium with carbon support catalyst also showed no appreciable decrease in catalytic activity as the nanoparticles were cycled through many reactions. While at a temperature of 200 degrees Celsius, several of the light gaseous alkanes were produced, while at even just a slightly higher temperature of 225 degrees Celsius, nearly all of the gaseous alkanes produced were methane. And this shows that this pathway could be viable to produce natural gas. The other gaseous alkanes produced at the optimal conditions for this study are used as fuel, like propane tanks for your grill and butane lighters. The liquid alkanes are used for fuel as well, like gasoline for your car, and as the carbon chain gets longer and longer, diesel and jet fuels. And then those very long chains can be used for motor oil and other lubricants. But I'm a little wary of all this, only because we should be progressing away from burning fossil fuels. But at least in the meantime, it's better than pumping more of it out of the ground or dumping all the used plastic that people throw away in a landfill where it will sit for years and years and years. At least it's being recycled to get some additional uses out of it. The group is also looking to see if polypropylene and polystyrene are able to be processed in a similar way to get more uses out of discarded post-consumer plastics. So we go from consumer products like plastic bags and used plastic bottles utilizing ruthenium-based catalysts to transform these materials into useful products rather than having them sit in a landfill. And this is great. It's sustainable. But we still have the problem of having the current levels of carbon dioxide increasing and continuing to increase as we burn more carbon. There has to be a way that we can take the carbon dioxide from the air through some kind of carbon capture mechanism and use it in a sustainable way. Well, a team from the University of Oxford, among others, have developed an iron-based catalyst that can convert carbon dioxide into jet fuel, which are products in the C8 to C16 range, using sustainably sourced hydrogen. A series of potential catalysts were produced from citric acid, iron 3 nitrate nonahydrate, and other metal cation nitrate hydrates. After mixing these together and then burning the resulting slurries in air, they were tested to see which one would be best at hydrogenating carbon dioxide. The best one that was observed was an iron-based catalyst doped with manganese and potassium that showed an almost 40% effective rate at converting the carbon dioxide to jet fuel-level alkanes at nearly a 50% selectivity rate. Some of the light gaseous alkanes mentioned before, like propane and butane, were also produced. Now, I recognize that I haven't mentioned the thermodynamics of these potential sustainable reactions. On the very small scale, like milligram scale, these could work and have been shown to work, like I've described. But as these are all scaled up, it might become more difficult to pull off thermodynamically. But this is where the research needs to continue to be built upon. It may not work out in the long run, but these avenues have to be pursued because it might end up revealing a way that could be done on a very large scale. Another issue with the last couple of studies is that they both require hydrogen along with the catalyst to complete the transformation of these plastics or carbon dioxide into useful products. Is the hydrogen sourced properly? Could it be used in a way that doesn't increase its energy footprint to convert these materials into useful products? This also may end up producing a net negative energy or carbon footprint. And couldn't this hydrogen be used for hydrogen power or hydrogen fuel cells instead of these large-scale processes to produce more fossil fuels? Yes, and I'll talk about hydrogen power in a future episode, so stay tuned for that. But I think these techniques should be used in tandem with hydrogen power. Hydrogen power could be the energy of the future, but we still have a lot of plastic out there, so this will be a problem for a long time. And I just wanted to mention one more study I found, just to move away from all this serious talk about jet fuel, gasoline, carbon dioxide, hydrogen power, etc. It's just something that seems to me to be out of the blue, and I never would have thought of it. A team from Tianjin University in China, among others, have developed a modified anode catalyst to be used in an alkaline fuel cell using sugary drinks as the source of energy. That's right, in this study, sodas and juices and the sugar in them can be converted into electricity. Sugar, or sucrose, has a chemical formula of C12H22O11, so there are a lot of bonds available to be broken and a lot of energy to be tapped into. And using the high sugar content of the sodas and juices was shown to be a good source of power. For example, Pepsi was shown to have the highest power density of those tested with about 33.41 watts per square meter. For comparison, Sprite had a power density of 28.38 watts per square meter, apple juice with 20.63 watts per square meter, and Coca-Cola with 16.31 watts per square meter. And the modified anode catalyst was gold on a manganese oxide and carbon support. So this just shows that energy and catalysts can be provided from unusual sources, and these fuel cells could be used for low-power electronics. And maybe even a better use than actually drinking these sodas, if we could have a healthier eating habits as a society, even by such a small step as removing soda from your diet, it could help us be more sustainable. And with that, thanks for listening to SP3. And please don't forget to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review if you can. Also, if you would like to become a supporter of this podcast, please go to the show page on Anchor and click on support. I would really appreciate it. And if you want to reach out and leave a comment, ask a question, or give a suggestion, please feel free to email the show at spacesportsspectroscopy@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook and Instagram. Just search for SP3 Podcast and you'll find it. The show also has a Twitter account, at SP3 Podcast, which I try to be active on, so please give the show a follow on there too. Links to the socials and the research mentioned are in the episode description. Thanks. And I've heard a rumor that Grubbs Catalyst once ate all the food put out by the host of the party. It just could not keep its grubby hands off the veggie platter.